Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On September 9th, an estimated 24,000 inmates began the first ever national prison strike. It was timed to coincide with the 45th anniversary of the uprising at Attica, but was largely lost in an election-focused news cycle. Issues raised by the protesters in 29 penitentiaries included long-term isolation, inadequate health care, violent attacks, and what they argue is slave labor. That strike has largely subsided, but historian and author Heather Ann Thompson says the public doesn't really know what goes on behind the razor wire. She's author of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its Legacy, and is with us to talk about some of the issues for inmates then and now. Heather Ann Thompson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here.
We've heard a lot of complaints and even lawsuits about solitary confinement used as a disciplinary tactic, spoiled food, poor health care. Less about slave labor. When did this charge emerge?
Well, it's always been there. Unfortunately, prisons are such closed institutions that the general public rarely knows what issues are of most concern to the folks on the inside, either the prisoners or the guards. And certainly since we've had the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery, we've had a provision in there, an exception in the 13th Amendment that makes it possible to have slavery still exist in prisons. That is to say that prisoners are the group, people who've been convicted of a crime, who are still allowed to be forced to labor without remuneration. And so throughout history, this has raised its head as a problem, but has become a particularly acute problem with the mass incarceration we have today.
So that has never been revisited, the fact that convicted criminals were exempt from the 13th Amendment?
No, and in part this is because the origination of that exception had some complicated history. In fact, it had to do with trying to keep the South after the Civil War and those who had been in rebellion against the Union and had been convicted of crimes against the Union from being able to wield too much power after the Civil War. But of course, ultimately what it does is it allows the South after the Civil War and then the nation ever since then to be able to use prisons as places to extract labor for free.
So as it stands, all inmates capable of working are required to work. What kinds of jobs?
Well, they really have a range. There really is a range. It depends on the institution. There's a distinction to be made. There's work that goes on in state facilities and in federal facilities, making products and providing services for other state institutions. And then there is prison labor that is effectively leased out to private companies on the outside. And then there's labor that is contracted with the federal government. It's a particular program called PI, which is meant to provide job training on the one hand to prisoners, but also to provide services to private companies. And the long and the short of that is that prisoners across America work. Some work for nothing. Some work for pennies. Others ostensibly get a minimum wage. But the result of all of it is exploitation.
So of this leased work, how much is that worth? Do we know how much that adds to the economy?
Well, it's really interesting. We don't. And in part, that's because, as I mentioned, prisons are such extraordinarily closed institutions that their record keeping and what actually happens with regard to the factories inside of them is largely off limits to reporters, certainly to researchers. And frankly, there's been too little interest. We still need to have some comprehensive economic studies of the impact of prison labor on the broader economy. But what we do know, and this is meaningful, we do know that very concrete jobs that used to be on the outside prison walls now are in them, which means that people in the free world are not able to have those jobs. We do know that people inside who are meant to do those jobs, who are forced to do those jobs, don't have the same protections as workers on the outside, which means they have unhealthy conditions, unsafe conditions. They can't call in sick. They can't get workman's compensation for injuries on the job. And the bottom line that we know is that this has had a wage dampening effect. That is to say, merely the threat of being able to take labor into prisons has been very toxic for workers on the outside when they're trying to negotiate for a decent standard of living.
Now, let's unpack some of that. I'm reading some figures. Last year, federal inmates helped bring in nearly $472 million in net sales. Only 5% went to pay inmates. Is it fair to categorize this modern-day prison labor as slave labor?
Well, I think it is because it's conscripted and it's forced. And so we will quibble often as to whether it's slave labor if there is remuneration involved. But in some key respects, that's a red herring because work is not just about your wage, and indeed wages are. We're talking in some prison farms in Nevada, 6 cents a day. It's about the conditions and it's about your ability to resist. It's about your ability to say, I can't do this job or I won't do this job because it is unsafe. But perhaps most importantly, prisoners do want to labor. They do want to work. Work in itself is not the problem. The problem is that the only people making money off of these products and services and labor are state governments, federal government, and corporations. Just to give you a sense of what I'm talking about, it is not insignificant that when prisons try to market their prisoners as workers to companies on the outside, they do so very, very carefully. What they say is, this is a compliant workforce. This is a workforce that does not require workman's compensation. This is a workforce that won't call in sick. This is a workforce that has built-in oversight because, right, you've got the guards there to make sure they work. So that's the dimension to which it is exploitative and also unjust.
We're talking about the charge made by inmates across the country that they are, in effect, being used as slave labor. Heather Ann Thompson is with us. She's a professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its Legacy. We've opened up so many things to pick up upon. First of all, there's not a lot of sympathy from a lot of the public. The argument that it is expensive to house inmates. They should be generating income and paying back their debt to society. They are not entitled to the same kind of protections and wages as somebody in the free population.
Well, that is certainly an argument that is made, and I've certainly heard it. But one of the problems with the argument is it's really conflating vengeance and retribution with a criminal justice system that gives out sentences that need to be served, but they are meant to contain people, not to abuse them. So in other words, when someone is sentenced for time behind bars, they are sentenced to be removed from society. They are not meant to be tortured. They are not meant to be driven as slaves. They are not meant to be to have them in a situation, for example, where they don't have any money on the inside of prison, which, by the way, they need. They need it for sufficient food. They need it for supplies. And then say, we are going to revile you if you want to be remunerated for your labor. So it's a very simple issue when we don't think of prisoners as some other, when we understand that we have 2.5 million people in the system, which means that we're talking about American citizens. We're talking about people's mothers, brothers, fathers, sisters, children who are going to need to come out. They're going to need to have a skill, and they're going to need to be able to pay for their own children and support their own families, sometimes even when they're inside.
I want to go back to that, what you mentioned before about companies and prisons who are using this kind of labor. Congress did create a program, I think it was the late 70s, giving incentives to private companies to use prison labor. The website says it's the best kept secret in outsourcing, which brings up something you raised earlier about undercutting jobs in the public sector. How do labor unions feel about this kind of thing? Low wages inside of penitentiaries amount to really stiff competition.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And that's why even a short-term retributive point of view that prisoners deserve to be driven as slaves inside of institutions is in some way so undercut by the broader societal argument now being made by labor unions that We're cutting off our nose to spite our face. If jobs are being taken out of communities on the outside and put into prisons on the inside, but neither the prisoners nor the workers on the outside are being paid, what in effect that does is it creates want and it creates need and on both sides of the walls. So who pays the price for all of that? Well, ultimately, taxpayers. Ultimately, we have a greater need for welfare. We have a greater need for food stamps. We have a greater need for all of that. So the only group making money off of this is the company that, for example, wants to sell baseball hats or wants to sell trophies or mattresses or drawers or, false teeth or eyeglasses or cleaning supplies. You know, listeners should go on the website of any state's correctional industries. It's fascinating because you can see the range of products that are being made inside of prisons. And just stop when you look at that list and think, what if all those jobs were in my town, right? What if all those jobs had not been removed? And then you quickly understand how this retributive model is really disastrous for workers on the outside as well.
Well, there has been quite a bit of press coverage on President Obama's commuting a record number of inmates. Some mention of prison reform with the Department of Justice moving forward to end all federal private prisons. But this nationwide strike on September the 9th, not a lot of attention for that. Almost a near media blackout. Were there any real gains?
Well, indeed, it's very difficult to tell. It is really extraordinary that, again, these are public institutions that we pay for. We trust to ostensibly to uphold our justice system, and nobody can get inside to figure out what's going on. And that includes the media, but it also includes state senators. It includes various oversight committees. So one of the reasons that there's a media blackout is that, frankly, journalists are loath to publish stories about something that they can't corroborate. You know, what is happening? How many prisoners are on strike? What has the impact been? The only reason we know what we know, quite frankly, is because the prisoners themselves have been determined to get the story out, and the guards have been determined to get the story out. And I just want to remind our listeners that this is always the way it's been. When there was an enormous prison uprising, including a critique of prison labor at Attica Prison in 1971, terrible, terrible things happened on the inside of that place to people who dared to protest. But why do we know about it? Because the prisoners insisted on bringing the media inside so they could see for themselves what had gone wrong. And the reason why that ended so violently was that the state of New York sent in armed troopers. It was a bloodbath. But America knew about it because, again, the media was there and the folks on the outside were there to make sure everyone knew. Well, today's prison strike, word coming from the inside out is that there have been terrible abuses. Kinross Prison in northern Michigan, not only were men pelleted with tear gun gas pellets, but they were shackled. They were stood in the rain. They were roughed up. They were moved out. There is now a story that a man died after not receiving proper medical care after that retaking at Kinross. So, in fact, there are abuses going on for the people who dared to protest today, but we don't know what they are, or at least we don't know the full extent of it, because we are so effectively shut out of it.
Well, Heather Ann Thompson, thank you for opening the door at least a little way for us today.
Thank you so much.
Professor Heather Ann Thompson from University of Michigan. She's also author of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its Legacy. You can find more about her and her book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.